speaker is Dermot, and he's going to speak on the politics of mental health, Marxism and psychology for...
No idea.
No idea how long he's going to talk for. Okay, well, I'll start sort of kicking you in the ankles after about half an hour. Yeah, we'll do the usual thing. After he's been kicked in the ankles or so for half an hour, we'll open up the meeting to contributions and questions. And if you could keep your contribution to roughly about 3 minutes to start with, so that everybody gets an opportunity to make a contribution if they wish, then, you know, if you've got more to say, you can always come in and make a second contribution if you've got a lot to say. Right, okay, we've got one or two apologies. James and Jeannie are sunning themselves in Sardinia. Tim and Jane are sunning themselves in Croatia. Not sure what's happened to Mark, but we've got apologies from him, and we've sort of got an ongoing apology from Ray. I don't know about anybody else, but anyway, I apologise for them, whoever they are, if they're not here. Okay, so over to you.
Right, thank you for inviting me. The title of the talk, by the way, is the one I've got is Politics and Mental Health, Marxism and Psychology. Although, good Lord. yes, thanks for inviting me, although actually that's slightly misleading, because I think I invited myself. And the reason I invited myself to do this talk is that at Marxism, I just happened to notice this little booklet called pamphlet called Marxism and Psychology. 60 pages, and it you know, to exaggerate slightly maybe, it kind of knocked my head off. It really did impress me. It is short, it's punchy, it's efficient, it covers an enormous amount of territory, going through a whole range of psychological problems and situations that occur in society, and relates them throughout to our political ideas, the ideas of our political tradition, Marxism in particular. So that's what encouraged me to actually offer to do this. If you should have a crib sheet. old teachers going hard. So take your hand out, please, and look at the bottom half of the page, where there are 7 points, which actually I've taken from James's email circular. Anyone who looked at James' email circular at this meeting, I've rearranged the order a bit. So I'm just going to whiz through these in case I don't read some of the points I want to make. I'm just going to whiz through these and read them out if anyone hasn't got the email, and give a very, very short answer or short response. So the first one: psychology tends to see individuals as separate from society. Absolutely true. In reality, society changes us. In some ways creates us in very many ways. Number two, there is a crisis of mental health in modern capitalist society. Absolutely true. It's always, I think, been the Cinderella of the health services. And recent cuts have brought it much further into crisis. Number three, is our mental health, brackets either good or bad, the product of biological functioning of our brains? No. Period. Not at all. I'm not actually going to say very much about that response, because it is a whole gigantic subject which is actually kind of in a sense under dispute within Socialist Workers' Party at the moment. We'll say a bit more about that later. But the conclusion that I would argue strongly, and certainly I should have mentioned Susan Rosenthal, a Canadian psychiatrist who's written this, certainly her answer would be no, zilch. Nothing to do with biological function of our brains. So four, is it the result of often distorted social relationships predominant in a class society? Yes. And this is certainly still hardly ever recognised by professionals, and certainly not at all recognised by drug companies. Drug companies, you know, want a quick fix that they can make profit out of. Five, Marxists argue that all human experience, including our mental health, has to be seen in a social, historical context. Absolutely true. Alienation in particular, which I'm going to talk about later, Marx's idea of alienation, different forms of alienation that humans have from each other and also from any real control over their working lives, is the dominant feature, psychologically speaking, the dominant feature of capitalist society. And six, can Marxist ideas of alienation help us understand why brains kind of malfunction, in inverted commas, malfunction? Yes, I think you can. Organising together to get collective control is actually, as well as hopefully making the world a better place objectively, it's also therapeutic. In changing society, we change ourselves as well. And there's so much historical precedent and examples that one can use to absolutely prove that point. And lastly, can there be a fusion between Marxism and psychology? Yes, I think they can. Okay, now, anyone who's been listening to the news, which I'm sure is everybody, on Tuesday a story broke, which, against the recent trend, is actually quite interesting about this 15-year-old boy who was taken into psychiatric care, and I think he'd been there 6 weeks, and he died. And 2 years ago this was, 15. And an inquest on Tuesday had expert witnesses and studies, absolutely devastating criticism of the South London Health Trust, I think it's Bethlehem Hospital in South London, absolute criticism of the situation in this psychiatric unit where this young lad, Christopher Brennan, died. And two words which we used on the radio were demoralised, this is the staff, overworked, undertrained, underrecognised, totally demoralised and desensitised to the suffering of the patients. They just didn't know what was going on, and this kid who really, really shouldn't have died. So I presume other people saw that. Second point, I went off to do psychology in the 1960s, and I did it in university for 6 years. Psychology had recently become very, very popular, and I think it's been popular ever since, as an A-level subject, as a university choice. What I found quizzing fellow students when I first got to Durham, actually, when I first got there, was that almost all the students, certainly on my course, had personal experience, or relatives or friends had personal experience of mental illness of some form. It's very, very common. In my case, my older brother, Patrick, became schizophrenic in my young teens, in his middle teens, and he was hospitalised all his adult life. And, it was looking back, it was quite kind of disturbing to have, there he sat on the settee, over a period of a couple of years, going completely schizophrenic. It was about 1,000 or so times worse for him, but it wasn't very pleasant for me either. So that was one reason I kind of wanted to go off and investigate these things at university. But there was another big reason, which I didn't actually realise at the time was political, but which it certainly is, I think. I wanted to, and this was kind of a conscious motive for going off and doing psychology, I wanted to understand human nature, the idea of human nature, which was around in society then, of course, still is. And in particular, I wanted to answer the question, is there an innate, genetically driven, inevitable human nature that would in any way restrict the type of civilization, the type of society we have in the future? For example, is it going to be prevented from us achieving a harmonious and peaceful, no war, everyone has a job, and people disagree all the time but then never kill each other, a really peaceful, harmonious world, which I think is what socialism wants. Is there anything in an inbuilt innate human nature that can restrict what kind of society we'd ultimately achieve? And again, the answer, as I mentioned before, the answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, there's abundant evidence now that there's nothing in human nature which could anyway restrict that. So why are the ideas, the opposite ideas, that, well, human nature is a barrier, give up, you're just an idealist, what can we expect? People are selfish, people are greedy, some are intelligent, others are less, unintelligent. Some are criminal, etc., etc. All these ideas are still just as prevalent now, actually, in society as they were in the 1960s, after university. And the only explanation is, I think, is that it serves a political function for this particular case. So I'm not actually going to talk mainly about that particular point, but this is, I think, really important to sort of take on board. If anyone wants to query that, and I suspect there might be somebody who might want to query it, you can ask questions and make points out. Okay, another question. Is it politics? Because so far I've been kind of talking about individual reactions to the world. Now, obviously, we all have to deal with our own lives. We all have to sort out ourselves. and if an individual's emotionally disturbed, is deeply traumatized, unhappy, displaying disturbing behavior, This is a problem for them as an individual, and also their relatives, their friends, their community, and possibly the workplace. So it's not necessarily a political matter. I think, because it is so prevalent in society, and I'll go through figures in a moment, some data I've got there on how prevalent various psychological ailments are, because it is so prevalent, I think that makes it political. And if it falls disproportionately on working class people, it's not true that middle class people don't become mentally ill, they certainly do, and so do upper class people. But it actually, most of the curable, if you like, symptoms of the society we live in fall disproportionately on people who were poor, they're worried about being sacked, you know, people whose physical lives are really hard, and they're in the middle of a war zone, you know, I mean, the traumas in children in Syria and Palestine are just setting up psychological problems for generations. So I think it does, and therefore it's not just a political matter, it's a matter for socialist politics. Okay, quick comment on history. In the late 19th century, what's that? Just over a century ago. It started earlier, but by the time of the second half of the 19th century, almost everyone in society, whatever the politics, had really high hopes for science. They really did think that the recent, you know, successes in science and technology, kind of for centuries, could be applied to things like economics and sociology and psychology and anthropology, and that they would eventually solve, almost of their own accord, that the kind of standard, ordinary, mainstream processes of science could eventually solve all these psychological problems and social problems. This was kind of widespread belief. This is why Marx repeatedly said, Marxism is a science, the science of social change. I mean, Marx used the word science. Now, I think what's happened since then is that it didn't happen. It absolutely didn't happen. Economics, sociology, psychology, psychiatry have absolutely failed to be sciences, like physics and chemistry and the technologies are. And they failed because they could never have succeeded. And again, I'm not going to go into that at great length, but you have to look at everything very statistically and probabilistically, and you have to look at chaos, what's called chaos theory, which has come out of maths and science, to see why they failed. They never could actually be sciences. Now, they haven't failed entirely. I mean, you know, there are certain remnants of useful things which you could call scientific, the way that things are measured and the statistics applied to social problems, etc. You know, these kind of fairly limited things. But when it comes to theories as to why things happen and explaining causes of things, they've very, very largely failed. To start with, in the case of mental illness and psychology in general, it's very difficult, it's almost impossible, to even define what the problems are. I mean, take schizophrenia, which I mentioned earlier. There is very, very little disagreement after a century and a half that the condition was reckoned, wasn't called schizophrenia originally, but what's now called schizophrenia. There's very, very little agreement as to what it is. It's a bundle of symptoms. You might have some of them, not others. What causes it? Blank. Psychology and psychiatry has very little, I think, very little in the way of convincing explanations for this. There's a thing called, if you've heard of it, a thing called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistics Manual, the American Psychiatric Association, which has been going since about 1980. It's now in its fifth edition. I had one of them for a while. I chucked it out eventually. It's about an inch or more thick, hundreds of pages, thousands of categorizations and subcategorizations. It is fiction. It really is fiction. It's of very little use. The person who wrote the first one in 1980 quite recently came out and said, that was a mistake, I shouldn't have done that. It's a complete waste of space. This is the guy that actually wrote the first one. So there's absolutely no doubt that that it is very difficult to even define what, you know, what is mental illness and what isn't in humans. that's not to say that there isn't something there. Obviously there's something there that needs talking about, it needs explaining, and it needs people to discuss what can be done about it. For example, I'm sure everyone's had the experience of being approached by somebody in Chesterfield Town Centre on a Saturday. They come up to you and they start speaking. Within less than 1 second, you know if there's something wrong with them. If they're not all there, they're mentally ill, they're drunk. If they're not behaving in a kind of inverted commas, normally, if they're behaving in inverted commas, abnormal way, under a second, you know this, because the way they speak, what they say doesn't make sense, or they say things which do make sense, but they have actually no relevance to you. You know, well, what are you asking me about this? The body language can be odd, you know, and funny facial, unusual facial expressions or unusual body language. They might get angry for no apparent reason. You've all experienced this. You know straight away, there's some, and I'm going to put inverted commas around wrong, there's something wrong, there's something different about them. So it's not that there is no such thing as mental illness, mental health, of course there is. It's just that it's very, very difficult to actually define, and it's very difficult to say what the causes are, and if you don't know what the causes are, it's very difficult to say what, you know, what to actually do about it. I mean, for example, all those things I mentioned, somebody saying something to you that makes no sense, well, that's probably most of my talk so far, you know, half the conversations you actually have in the real world out there, you're probably halfway through, you think, I'm not quite sure what this guy's talking about. You know, that's not unusual in itself. First, people getting angry, well, people get angry, people have unusual mannerisms if they get angry and stuff. All these kind of symptoms aren't actually something ill or wrong in themselves. It's the inappropriateness of the situation. And therefore, you can only define mental illness by the situation and the appropriateness or inappropriateness of the person's behaviour in a particular situation. It is socially kind of defined, and I think that's a clue to where the causes lie. The causes lie in the social situation that people find themselves. All that can be said with certainty, I think, is that this person who comes up to you, I presume everyone's had this experience, and is you know, they've got some problem, or they're drunk, or they're whatever, maybe they've just seen somebody killed in a road crash, I don't know, but there's something that has made them extremely unhappy or traumatised about some situation or event that they've experienced. That is a correlation which is real, you know, and it's not like, again, it's you know, kind of past situations. And it's not genes, it's not biochemicals, it's not some predisposition to talking, you know, unintelligibly. It's something in the past sequence of situations that they found themselves in. Again, it's kind of socially generated. So how bad is it? Right, take your sheet, please, and look at the top half of the page. Government health spending on mental health in 2015 reached 11.7 billion. Well, that makes it fairly sizable. Government department. Well, no, it makes the size of a smallish government department. But if you look at the costs, the knock-on costs to individuals, companies, society, outside public expenditure, it's several times that. It's tens and tens of billions. One of the problems at the moment is that this has slipped compared to overall health spending, which hasn't actually kept pace with need, obviously. And when it comes to drug companies, and you know, drug restraint is the problem. You know, look at suicides, which is obviously a symptom of mental distress, mental trauma. Over 6,000 a year. Men three times more likely than women. In men, suicide kills more than heart attacks, cancer, or car accidents. Now, I've got that from the Samaritans. I've got around to checking it. Cancer. Is that more than cancers? That's what it says. So it needs checking, maybe. Globally, a figure I saw the other day, 800,000 suicides. That's coming up to 1 million people commit suicide globally per year. Looking at the rates, 1 in 4 people in the UK will experience a mental health problem in any particular year. And the rates are, well, I won't go through all these, depression, 2.6 out of 100, every 100 people. The highest one, they're mixed anxiety with depression. I don't quite understand that categorisation. These figures are from Mind, by the way. Yes, they are, yeah. Mental health charity called Mind. OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. I would have thought that was a lot commoner. I think probably 1.3%, 1.3 to 100. You could probably multiply that by 10.
Yeah.
For people who don't ever get to see a doctor, don't get referred. This is severe cases, which when it's severe, it is very debilitating. And so on. And then through to the more kind of serious things like bipolar, personality disorder, self-harming, this Brennan, this Christopher Brennan, who died, was self-harming in a chronic way, and he was just left on his own for hours and died. schizophrenia between 1 and 3. You can't say precisely. If you can't define what it is, you can't say precisely. But between 1 and 3 people being actually diagnosed as schizophrenia, per 100, there's a large number of people. It's very, very common out there. And another figure I saw on the Mind website, I think it was, for every pound spent on early intervention, estimated £18 saved on knock-on costs if, you know, if that early intervention isn't there. Okay, in fact, I'm sort of halfway through. I'll miss that. Okay. So, explanations, I've mentioned that already. I'm going to talk about when I was doing psychology, the subject that I took, an option I took, was called clinical psychology, and all the textbooks were called abnormal psychology. And I found this little metaphor, if you like, this little story the other day on a blog of the British Psychological Society. And this Jonathan Kohler says, if you think what happens after a car crash, accident investigators, they come in, they measure elements of the situation, like the weight of the vehicles, the road surface, or the condition of the road surface, whether it was raining or not, whether the road surface was wet or dry, tyre pressures, condition of brakes, that kind of thing. But what they don't do is they don't then apply a special branch of physics called abnormal physics to this car crash, which actually, you know, treats, say, coefficients of friction differently. It's not an abnormal coefficient of friction law, and other laws governing friction, you know, which is different, which is not normal. There's only one set of laws of friction, which are used, hopefully, to design better tyres, safer vehicles, better roads, and, you know, better driving habits, and so on. And similarly, this guy's arguing, and I absolutely agree with it, there really isn't, or shouldn't be, a thing called abnormal psychology. The same set of rules, although they're very difficult to pin down, actually do give rise to some people having these, you know, these mental symptoms and other people not. The same rules, and it's a kind of a process of chaos I mentioned before. Accident of a whole sequence of experiences and reactions to those experiences, which lead some people to become mentally ill and other people not to become mentally ill. And it, you know, it's quite difficult to actually find out exactly what that sequence of events is. But it's not that the rules are different for sane people and insane people. The actual basic rules, no matter how hard it is to identify those rules. And so this is, I think, a false dichotomy. The phrase is used, and there is a tendency to see people, insane people over here, sane people over here. I think this is a false distinction, a false dichotomy. The two are very much muddled up and smudged up. Also, there's a tendency, I'm not going to say anything more about it, which I'm sure you all know about. There's a tendency, physical diseases over here, well, he's got cancer, he's got, you know, diabetes, he's got whatever it is. And here's a person over here, he's got neurosis, he's depressed, he's got schizophrenia, whatever. They're actually really, really muddled up. If you get physical disease and you can't get out of the house, you're almost certainly going to become depressed. You're almost certainly become, you know, overweight. Well, that makes you more depressed. And the other way around, if you get something psychological, it almost certainly leads on to physical. Stress diseases, your ulcers, you get all sorts of. The two are really absolutely interlinked. That's not so much disputed nowadays in society. And then, of course, the final, most notorious of these false dichotomies, the nature-nurture debate, which I've already given my answer to. But as far as, and this is, I've been ages working out this sort of conclusion, if you like, this bottom line conclusion. If you look at those features of personality and behaviour in adults, which are of kind of social significance or economic or historical significance or political significance, there is absolutely no involvement of genes and genetics whatsoever. Zilch. That leaves a space for a very small percentage of schizophrenias, and it's definitely nowhere more than 5%, where there may be some kind of chemical imbalance. It may not even be genetic, but maybe some kind of chemical imbalance. I mean, our consciousness, our brain, is a physical organ, obviously. And if the chemicals are completely haywire, you're going to hear voices, you're going to have hallucinations, you're going to behave strangely. So, I mean, that's kind of inevitable. But the chemical imbalance is probably a symptom of something going on psychologically. So there, I'm just repeating the same kind of point, that when it comes to significant adult human personality behaviours, there's no involvement of genetics whatsoever. And society hasn't accepted this. Capitalist society doesn't accept it. So just to finish off with two more points. I missed that out altogether. Just to say that I was going to talk about consciousness. The function of consciousness in evolutionary terms, the reason why we've developed a human consciousness, which is massively bigger and more complex and more nuanced and more, you know, sort of affecting and controlling the environment than any other species on the planet, has evolved to control. Our brain has evolved so that we can actually control our environment, manipulate our environment to our, you know, by growing crops. You know, chimpanzees don't grow crops. They have 98% the same genes as us, and physically they look like us. But they don't go out and plant wheat and then harvest it, you know, 6 months later or whatever. So we've evolved this brain to actually be in control. And if there's anything that prevents that control, it's traumatic, it's disturbing, and that's exactly what capitalism does to most people most of the time, in small ways or sometimes big ways. It takes away control. And Marx talked about that, he called it alienation. A phrase which he didn't invent, but he actually picked it up and talked about it a lot. And I've got a number of ways, and I'll finish quite quickly, I hope. So what Marx argued, and I don't think there's any disputing it, is that human beings, under capitalism, these things apply to some extent under previous class society, slave society, medieval serfdom, etc. But they've kind of got worse in many ways under capitalism. So we are alienated from the process of the work that we do. This is almost, in a sense, the most important thing that we do. Well, work, reproduction, you know, these are the major things that humans do of importance. And we are alienated from the control of the work process. We have to do what the boss says. Tiny elements of democracy, but very, very small ones. Democracy is for far away in Westminster. There's almost no, or literally no, democracy in workplaces. The product of our work, the service or the goods that we produce, they're taken away by the management, by the owners of the company, and sold. The capital, you know, this capital, which of course is useful to controlling the future, that's it. We don't own that. The boss takes the profit. You know, we're given enough to feed us so we can go off and have kids and produce the next layer of workers and so on. But the, you know, the cream, the surplus is taken up by the boss. I think you all know this. And so humans are alienated from the general priorities and directions that society takes under capitalism. Parliament isn't there to discuss. I mean, this is what Corbynism and the debate between Corbyn and the right-wing Labour MPs is all about. Parliament wasn't actually put in place in Britain and other countries in order to change the direction of society and make it fundamentally different. It was there to manage capitalist class society as it is. Manage it hopefully more harmoniously, maybe more efficiently, but let's manage it. Not by us, by other people. And we're alienated from each other, which kind of inhibits what Marx calls species consciousness, species empathy. Now, if all humans empathise, you know, people empathise with their, you know, with their relatives, their friends, the family, and the people at work, but not everybody actually empathises and identifies with the whole species. Now, I'm lucky, you know, I've always done this. My mother was said repeatedly, people in every country are the same, really, under the skin, you know, it's good to, and she had all these kind of liberal sentiments. So I grew up knowing that I was like a human being, we're all pretty well basically the same. That species consciousness, I mean, just luck that my mother was a liberal-minded person, kept saying these things. Other people aren't like that. They think that it's a bit different, especially the English, or middle class, or male, or sane, or white, or whatever it is. And even alienated from ourselves. That part of our mind which has a propensity to actually control things to our benefit, we're cut off from that because it isn't given much of a ability to actually do that. So, I'm going to finish on two things. Am I allowed to do that?
You better be quick.
Okay. I'm going to give you a story from Poland in 1980-1981. I've never got around to checking this, and a lot of people here will know this. You see Paul grinning here, he knows what I'm going to say. He needs checking this, but this is the story that I've read in several different places, that in Poland, you may know, in 1980-81, the people of Poland, the workers of Poland, rebelled against Russian Stalinist kind of dictatorship, and they formed a trade union called Solidarność. And it was very successful. They went to go on strike, they occupied factories, they chucked the boss out, and it was a kind of a partial revolution that lasted months. And something interesting happened. After a while, mental patients began discharging themselves, and they were like half full. Mental hospital wards, which had been packed before, and it was so much more exciting outside, they suddenly became sane enough to go out. And then there was a month or so's pause, and then something else happened. They started filling up again with Communist Party officials, with policemen, with the bosses of workplaces. And that really, I think, true or not, I don't care if it's not true, that is literally, you know, what it will happen. Because people are so ground down by this alienation and exploitation and all that difficulties, psychological difficulties of life. If you feel you've got some chance of actually getting in control, a revolution takes place inside your head. And every we know with absolute certainty, and like just going down to picket lines, a little strike at some little factory, you go and talk to people on strike, and they're, eyes are shining, are they interested in the one to talk about philosophy and history, you know, from never showing interest in their lives. So not only does final conclusion, not only does capitalism fail to solve problems of previous forms of minority class rule, it creates new special problems all the time and fails to solve those either. It doesn't actually offer any or many solutions. In fact, I think capitalism probably wouldn't last a day if everybody was happy and secure and wise and balanced and understood how the world worked. We wouldn't put up with what we put up with. Politicians that go off to Westminster for their career, advertisements that are basically brainwashing to class the ladder and get a Porsche, or it's Lamborghini, like Porsches are cheapskates, aren't they? Lamborghini or Ferrari, climb the class ladder and consume. And people wouldn't put up with that if. And so it's not that the capitalist system can't solve these psychological problems. It can't afford to solve them. It doesn't want to solve them. It actually needs all these problems to keep us messed up, more or less. I finished.
Thank you.